Blog Talk Radio.
It's the Morning Show.
Okay, you want to rehearse it one time before we go in there?
With award-winning journalist Cheryl Smith.
I'm good. I'm not that good.
Bringing you informative, enlightening, thought-provoking, inspiring, and entertaining talk radio.
She touched me. No, you cannot hear.
This is Norma Adams Wade, and just trying to make sure you can hear me. You're watching and listening to I Was Just Thinking. Been doing a lot of that lately. I'm your host, Norma Adams Wade, and as I always remind you, you are my co-host. And yes, I stole that from TV personality Wendy Williams. Today, later today, we're going to have an exciting guest, and I will wait. I'll keep you wondering. You'll see a little bit about it scrolling across your screen. But we're going to talk about a lot of different things. Right now, it's just shortly after 11 a.m., and the date is May 19, and we'll talk about the significance of this date in a little bit. I just want to tell you before we really get into various things to talk about, I want to tell you that if you want to know more about the various topics that we talk about, which have strong relevance for the African American community here in the Dallas area and very often state and national plans, you can pick up one of the publications by publisher Cheryl Smith's Media Enterprise, and they include the Texas Metro News, and let me just kind of show you one of the, I hope you can see it, one of the recent publications, and this one is talking about the South Dallas Business and Professional Women's Club, whose annual B. Alice Foster Trailblazing Award will be June 12th. We hope you'll go to that. That's one recent publication. And you can pick it up at various retail shops, Lubies, Walmart, Martin Luther King Center, if you can get in, and the Black Chamber, and just various sites that African Americans largely frequent throughout the city of Dallas. The other one is the Garland Journal. And one interesting thing about this recent publication is that Cheryl Smith has been running series about Superb Women. This was a collection from April, but on her online publication, which is iMessenger Media, and the print publications, different individuals are nominating superb women who are really doing things and they are being featured in one of the publications. So that's iMessenger Media, that's the Garland Journal, and Texas Metro News. Here's another more recent publication of Texas Metro News, and this one features Deborah Peoples in Fort Worth, who is running for mayor, and she's a powerhouse. She also was one of the women featured as a superb woman. So I just want to pull your attention to these publications and the information that you can learn about what's going on in the African-American community in Dallas. Now, let me talk about my mask. I always tell you that I wear this mask. For one thing, I'm in an office building with other people, and I want to honor health guidelines. Now, I know that there, the governor, Abbott, has recently issued an order that it's no longer necessary to wear a mask in public and as you go into retail stores and all like that. Well, let me do this before I tell you a little bit more about that. Because I am in a room by myself, I'm going to go ahead and lower my mask. But Governor Abbott has issued this ruling that you no longer have to wear your mask in public places. I'm going to continue to wear mine in public places. You can make your own decision about that. I do feel strongly that a lot of these legal directives are politically inspired, depending on your political stance, that these rulings are made. And I think that about the mask ruling. I've heard a lot of people say, well, there are strong opinions on both sides. Folk who really want to get rid of the mask have said, yay, I can breathe now. I'm not handcuffed by this, they call a silly ruling. So they're celebrating. And then other people are saying, well, you know, it's a little early to tell us that we no longer are bound by law to wear our mask in public gatherings. And so they're very uneasy about it. My personal choice is that I'm just going to wear mine until such time that I feel I no longer need to. But anyway, that's that. Today is May 19th. And guess what it is? May 19th is the birth date of human rights advocate Malcolm X, known also as El-Haji, El-Malik, El-Shabaab. He was born May 19, 1925. And I just wanted to spend some time giving honor to his memory and the things he was able to accomplish. I did want to point out that across the nation, different communities will be holding different events either today or on the 21st, which legally is the holiday, the federal holiday on February 21st, but he was actually born on the 19th. And so there's one that kind of caught my interest. This one is a rally to protest a liquor license renewal of a liquor store. This is in Washington, D.C., but the store is on Malcolm X Avenue in Washington, D.C. And the folk who organized this protest that will be today on the birthday of Malcolm X, they're saying that this liquor store goes against the image and the purposes and the goals of advocates for our culture, that instead of bringing in retail stores that will provide groceries or a bank that will provide economic service or even fruit stands and vegetable stands where people can get fresh produce. They're advocating that that community there in Washington, D.C., by Malcolm X Avenue, rather than the state renewing the liquor license or a liquor store, give the people solid needs, like I said, a bank or a grocery store, even a fresh produce provider. And so that's one thing that's kicking off today, which is the 19th. But let's talk a little bit about Malcolm X. Again, he was born on May 19 in 1925. And today he would have been 96 years old. Today, Malcolm X would have been 96 years old. Of course, his stance in the world, and we'll talk about how he got to be who he was, but he offered an alternative view to the mainstream view of the civil rights movement. He advocated for establishing a separate, initially, now he changed over the years, but when he became initially prominent, he advocated for a separate community of descendants of Africa rather than integration. He was not a proponent of integration initially. And he believed in defending yourself if you had to get a little bit violent. Initially, he believed in that. He was the opposite of his counterpart, who was Martin Luther King Jr., who did advocate for nonviolence. Malcolm X was born Malcolm Little. He was born in Omaha, Nebraska. His father, I always forget this, his dad was a Baptist minister. And I have to just kind of remind myself because I always forget that. And his dad, interestingly enough, was a follower of Marcus Garvey's Universal Negro Improvement Association, and it was a pan-African movement in the 1920s. Now, we know the 1920s were a tough, well, all decades have been tough for descendants of Africa, but particularly in that era, the Ku Klux Klan was very powerful and very out front. His mom grew up in Grenada. Malcolm X was the fourth of six children that his parents had. Now, as a child, Malcolm would attend these Marcus Garvey organization meetings, and his dad, as I said, was president of the Omaha chapter. And Malcolm absorbed a lot of the philosophy of Marcus Garvey, a prominent African-American leader during that period of time. And he strongly argued for independence, that African-Americans needed to be independent from white society. Now, once his dad began to draw attention of the Klan, he moved his family to Lansing, Michigan. And it was a largely white neighborhood where they moved, and but of course the white neighbors were not happy. And so in 1929, a group of white supremacists set fire to the home of the Malcolm X's parents. And the family was inside the house, but fortunately they managed to escape, and they had to stand there and watch their house burn to the ground. Guess what? Firemen came and they just stood there and did nothing. Fireman just stood there and watched the house burn to the ground. But Malcolm's dad was a tough man. He was not intimidated to be silent by the action that these white supremacists, even though it almost cost the life of him and his family. But Malcolm X's dad ended up being murdered when Malcolm was 6 years old. He had been beaten, and then he was left on the tracks of a trolley car tracks, and the trolley ran over his dad's body. His dad has naturally died. It is very well believed that the white supremacist group were responsible, but no legal charges were brought. In fact, his dad had a life insurance policy, but the company ruled that his dad's death had been a suicide, and they would not pay, even though his dad had been paying the insurance policy all that time. Now, these events weighed heavily on his mom, Miss Louise Little, weighed heavily on her, and it plunged the family into deep poverty. Now, this was during the Great Depression, so it's already the Depression. And then the dad is murdered. Nothing legal is done about it. There are these six children the surviving mom has to try to take care of. And it took a toll on her, and she plunged into a depression. And she developed mental illness and finally was committed to a mental hospital there in Michigan. So after that, the children were separated, and Malcolm at the time, by this time, when his mother was committed, he was 13 years old, and he was sent to a foster home, and it did not go well. He was soon put in a detention home. His life was very unstable, but he was successful in school. Believe it or not, it was a mixed race school, and Malcolm still excelled. But it really got him when he was just doing so well, earning top grades, and one of his Anglo teachers, Malcolm had expressed something about wanting to maybe become a lawyer, and the teacher said, no, that's not for you. You need to maybe become a carpenter. And that really disturbed Malcolm, and he began to withdraw from that environment mentally, and eventually he met his half sister Ella, who was in Boston, and he asked to live with her, and she allowed him to come. He had just finished eighth grade when he moved to Lansing. He moved from Lansing to Boston. And then he was befriended by a hustler, a street hustler. And this guy, they called him Shorty, he got Malcolm a job shining shoes. This was mainly at a ballroom, the Roseland Ballroom there, and where a lot of noted bands played. But as it turned out, while he was shining shoes, and he was kind of proud to have the job, but the people who were his customers, they wanted Malcolm to help them to find drugs, and so it brought money to Malcolm, and he ventured into that part of life, and he even developed a drug habit himself with cocaine, and his criminal behavior soon followed. He ended up being arrested at age 21 for burglary, and he was sentenced to 10 years in prison. He was sent to the Charleston State Prison in Boston. And then at age 23, he was transferred to a prison in Massachusetts. And it was there that his brother, Malcolm's brother called Reginald, introduced Malcolm to the Nation of Islam. Now, the Nation was originally founded in 1930 by Wallace D. Fogg, and it was a black Muslim organization that believed that descendants of Africa were inherently superior to Anglo people, and they predicted that the Anglo race would soon reach destruction. But Fogg mysteriously disappeared in 1934, and Elijah Muhammad took over the organization, and he was known as the Messenger of Allah. Now, Malcolm really got interested in the Nation, and while he was in prison, his relatives and loved ones were personally visiting him and writing letters, and Malcolm began to learn more and more about the Nation, and he would go to the prison library and read all of about what he could find out, as well as other subjects. He became an avid, and he rediscovered his interest in education that he had excelled at as a young child. And then in 49, at the age of 24, he converted to the Nation of Islam, which inspired him to completely rid himself of any drug habits that he had had. And then at age 27, he got out of prison. I think it served maybe by that time roughly 6 years of the 10-year sentence. And he immediately joined with the Nation, and he became a prolific writer. And at this point in his life really set him on an upscale from that point. He became an activist. He moved to Detroit and began recruiting people for the Nation. And Elijah Muhammad became Malcolm's mentor and his hero, and which helped fill the void that his brother by that time had died. And so Elijah Muhammad filled that void that Malcolm was looking for a mentor and a hero. And then at age 28, he changed his name from Malcolm Little to Malcolm X. And of course, the philosophy was that the descendants of Africa, that our last names were acquired from Europeans who had owned descendants of Africa as enslaved people. So he changed his name to Malcolm X. Now, he was very charismatic and a passionate speaker and leader, and he quickly rose in the Nation, and he became minister of the Temple 7 in Harlem at age 29. And at that time, he also founded Muhammad Speaks, and that was the Nation's newspaper. And he was a very good journalist for that publication, which is still published. Muhammad Speaks is still published. So while he was being the head of Temple 7, he met a young nurse. And her name at the time was Betty Saunders. We know her as Betty Shabazz. But they married at age when Malcolm was 33 in 58. And they went on to have six children, four daughters and a set of twins. So it was six daughters, four daughters plus the two twins. And then larger society began to take note of him, and a CBS documentary on Malcolm X aired, and then, of course, his notoriety took off, and the documentary was called Nation of Islam, The Hate That Hate Produced. And what they meant by that was that African descendants of Africa were considered hated people, and as a result, the Nation of Islam turned that emotion back on the ones who initially put it out. And so he did become, his notoriety really unsettled European people, and they were really very uneasy with his prominence. They were much more comfortable with Martin Luther King Jr., even though Martin was nobody's pushover. But they were different philosophies: nonviolence versus, yeah, if I have to use violence, then I'm good at it. I'm good with it. But then jealousy developed among other ministers in the nation. And by this time, it was around 60-61. And Malcolm X became aware of the jealousy of many of the other leaders, and that they envied his ability to really connect with people and his prominence and how he was getting so noticed. And then in 62, rumors began to reach Malcolm that his hero, Elijah Muhammad, was having affairs. Now, Malcolm had really put Elijah Muhammad on a pedestal as a very pure man, a very family-oriented, faithful, devoted person. And when he found out that, yes, it was true that Elijah Muhammad even had four children by other women, and that devastated Malcolm, and he did not take it well. But he tried to stay the course, and then the assassination of John Kennedy happened. That was, of course, November 22nd, 1963. And Malcolm X made which became a notorious statement that the chickens have come home to roost. Now, the general public took that to mean that he was applauding the assassination of Kennedy, but Malcolm later tried to explain that what he meant was that the behavior of white supremacists and Anglos who turned their noses up at descendants of Africa and had done such ill treatment of them finally had gotten a taste of what they had been putting out. But Elijah Muhammad ordered Malcolm X to be silent. He ordered him to, quote unquote, to be silenced for about 90 days. Now, Malcolm accepted his discipline. He accepted it. But it soon made him realize that there was just too much going on that he could not accept. And so he left the nation. And then in 64, he formed his own organization, his own faith-based organization, and it was called Muslim Mosque Incorporated. And it drew in people who also had left the nation. And he also turned to traditional Islam, not black Muslims, but traditional Islam. And then he began a pilgrimage to Mecca, which is in Saudi Arabia. And while he was in the Middle East, he noticed the wide diversity of complexions and ethnicities there. And when he returned home, he began to rethink his earlier positions about separating from that descendants of Africa should be their own separate society. He began to think about that. He changed his name for the second time, and he became El Hajj Malik El Shabazz. And then he went. He did a lot of traveling. He toured Africa, and he promoted more widely the philosophy of Marcus Garvey, and he began his own Pan-African movement, and it was called the Organization of Afro-American Unity, and it advocated for human rights of descendants of Africa. And he, through this organization, he met diverse world leaders, and his actions and his programs and planning were far more diverse than the Nation of Islam. And whereas once he had shunned white society, he now encouraged that Anglo learn more about what he was teaching them and about the damage that oppression of people of color, well, the damage that it does. And so running the Muslim Mosque Inc. and the Organization of African American Unity, that, and doing all the speaking and traveling, it really became exhausting for Malcolm. And he publicly was very aware again of that, the hate and jealousy that was felt, that other Muslim ministers felt toward him. And his home, as a result, was firebombed, just like his dad's home had been. And this was in February of 65. And his home was in New York, and it was firebombed. And but he did not let that attack sidetrack him. He still continued his traveling and his speaking. He went to Selma, Alabama, and he returned to New York, he accepted a speaking engagement at the Audubon Ballroom in Harlem, and that was on February 21st in 1965. Now, we know that in 65, Lyndon Baines Johnson was president. And of course, Martin Luther King Jr. was doing a lot of things that moved the civil rights movement forward. So those juxtaposed activities were going on right about the same time. Now, 1 year before February 21st, Johnson had signed the 64 Civil Rights Act. To fight against discrimination. And then 1 month before, months before this pivotal date of February 21st, Johnson had signed the 1965 Voting Rights Bill. A lot of civil rights activity was going on. But back to the Audubon Ballroom. That was, in fact, as we all know, Malcolm X's, El Hajj Malik El Shabazz's last speech. He was at the podium. A commotion broke out in the middle of the crowd, which drew attention away from what was going on at the podium. And three men in the audience stood up and fired 15 bullets And most of them hit, if not all of them, hit Malcolm and killed him. He died before he reached the hospital. Oh boy. So after that, all kind of chaos and pandemonium broke out. Supporters of Malcolm went into the streets, and there was mob violence. A black Muslim mosque was firebombed. But critics, who again still were not pleased with Malcolm, and this even included Elijah Muhammad, they maintained that he had brought this death on himself. Now, the three men were, one of them was arrested at the scene, and then later on, very shortly, the other two were taken into custody, and all three were convicted of Malcolm X's murder. But even to this day, many people think that there was much more going on and much more untold about the behind-the-scenes planning and carrying out of the assassination of Malcolm X than maybe we'll ever know. Maybe we won't ever know the full story and what was behind it. So in the months following his death, noted author Alex Haley did publish the autobiography of Malcolm X. Now, Malcolm X had been working with Alex Haley on putting his autobiography together. He would dictate the information to Alex Haley, and Alex Haley would put it together in a written form. And Malcolm X died, the book was published, but we benefited from it. And I can personally tell you that the autobiography of Malcolm X is one of the most popular books to come out of the history of the African-American community, Descendants of Africa. It was published in 65, just months after Malcolm was murdered. And an offshoot of his philosophy was that the Black Panthers picked up a lot of his teachings, and they organized 1 year later in 66. The Black Panthers organized 1 year later in 66. And of course, they did a lot of service in the African American community. Of course, FBI was very uneasy with the Panthers, although they were doing a lot of good in the community, but they believed in standing up and speaking up. And of course, now pretty soon the Black Power movement became strong in the early 70s. And so again, today, which is May 19, the day that Malcolm X was born, he would have been 96. We know that, and we might even be able to say, if you want to just stretch it a little bit, that the Black Lives Matter movement could be viewed as a branch growing out of the roots that Malcolm X planted. He was a tough brother. He was smart. He was charismatic. He was steadfast. He was fearless, as apparently his dad was. We're grateful for the life of Malcolm X, and we salute him today. It is now about 11:40. You are watching and listening to the Blog Talk Show. I was just thinking, I am Norma Adams Wade, your host, and you are my co-host. This blog is brought to you by the Media Enterprise of publisher Cheryl Smith. That includes Texas Metro News, the Garland Journal, and the iMessenger Media, which is the online publication. The other two are print, and iMessenger Media is online. And we're drawing close pretty soon to the arrival of our guest. But before our guest arrives, let me just kind of tell you some other things that are going on in the news right now. It's been kind of talked about this week, you know, Eddie Bernice Johnson, she is completing her 15th term as a congresswoman in D.C. And time will end in 2023. Now, she represents District 30 in the southern part of Dallas. And she won her most recent election in November 2020. Media has called her, get this, one of the most powerful figures in Texas politics. She's a beautiful 85 years old. What's interesting is that the people have been speculating for some time, and many of the previous elections, is this going to be her last? Is she going to go home and sit down? She's not telling. She's not telling, but contenders are lining up. Now, here's some of the people whose names have been mentioned as potential people to succeed her, who are going to launch, and some of them have already announced. One of them is Jane Hamilton. She's a veteran Dallas political consultant, and she wants to chair Joe Biden's presidential primary campaign. Now, Reverend Dr. Freddie Haynes has kind of lined up with her to help her in her campaign. So that speaks well. That speaks well of her. Other possible contenders are Jessica Mason. She's a Navy veteran, and she has expressed interest in succeeding Congresswoman Eddie Bernice Johnson. State Representatives Tony Rose and Yvonne Davis, and even Carl Sherman of DeSoto. Rose and Davis represent Dallas, and Sherman is of DeSoto. They've expressed interest. State District Judge Elizabeth Frizzell, her name has been mentioned as a possible contender. State Senator Royce West, his name has been put out there. That would be interesting. State Rep. Royce West, if he should decide to announce for that seat, should Congresswoman Eddie Bernice Johnson decide to leave office. Another is former State Rep. Barbara Mallory Caraway. Now, she has run against Congresswoman Johnson at least a couple of times prior. There also has some interest has been expressed from Democrat Shanita Cleveland. She's a criminal justice parole worker. And also Democrat Hassani Burden, who's an entrepreneur, has his own company, and he also ran for District 7 City Council. So he has shown political interest. And so we'll stay tuned to see what in the world will Congresswoman Eddie Bernice Johnson decide to do. Now, when she, the previous times, political operatives almost begged her not to leave because Former President Barack Obama was coming into office and wanted to get a lot of his programs going. And she knows, she is so astute in her political role and has become, as the media calls her, one of the most powerful figures in Texas politics. She did go ahead and keep her office a couple of times. But we'll see. We'll see what she decides to do. Now, here's another interesting news item that kind of intrigued me. In Columbia, South Carolina, last week or so, toward the weekend of last week, the legislators in South Carolina, they are considering adding a firing squad as a method of execution. Now, we know that lethal injections right now are the most popular way of carrying out the death penalty through a lethal injection. But in Columbia, South Carolina, it has been introduced that they add a firing squad. Now, this kind of came up because lethal injection drugs are becoming in short supply. So they thought, well, let's try a firing squad. That's very interesting to me. Now, Governor Henry McMaster has said that if such a bill does make it to his desk, that he will consider signing it. And part of the bill will say that the person on death row can choose their method of death, either by execution or being with the firing squad if no lethal injection is available. Now, if this does pass, South Carolina will be the fourth state to allow the firing squad. The other states have already instituted, three other states have already instituted it: Mississippi, Oklahoma, and Utah. Now, other things that have intrigued me this past week, you know, the National Rifle Association. I chuckle because, well, I won't get into that. Let me keep my personal opinions to myself. But the National Rifle Association has expressed interest in moving to Texas from Fairfax, Virginia. Now, they have been suffering some financial setbacks because of a lawsuit. Now, the suit was brought by New York Attorney General Letitia James. She sued the group in August of 2020, saying, and the suit claims that they were using self-dealing methods and misspending to promote their cause. Now, their defense was that they were trying to avoid bankruptcy. So we'll pick up there. We'll put a pause in that, and we're going to take a brief break, and then we will return.
The people, God, you know what they want. truth, the truth, and no more lies. We want freedom, justice, and equality.
Now, He also served as director of intercultural education and minority student affairs at Southern Methodist University. And in addition to that, while he was at SMU on staff, he was coordinator of African American Student Services, and he was an adjunct professor of African American Studies. Now, he was at Southern Methodist University on the education staff for more than 15 years. After SMU, he joined the Dallas Independent School District, and he was a special assistant to the general superintendent. He was in intercultural relations, and he was executive director of multicultural education for DISD. Now, it's well known that he is very schooled in the life and work of Dr. Martin Luther King Jr. and the Civil Rights Movement. Now, in 86, Mrs. Coretta Scott King, Dr. King's wife, Professor Glover, to serve as the coordinator and interviewer for the classic PBS documentary called In Remembrance of Martin, the first National Martin Luther King Jr. Holiday Observance. And it was filmed in Atlanta. Professor Glover is also an author. A delightful book called The Night Before Freedom. And it's about the Emancipation and Juneteenth observance. But it is written from the angle of emancipation. And it's also a children's coloring book. He's an avid drummer as well and a storyteller. And he's also an ordained Christian Methodist Episcopal minister. Now, there is Professor Clarence E. Glover Jr. Welcome.
Welcome. Thank you so much. Thank you so much. I'm delighted to be with you today.
I'm having trouble hearing you.
Can you hear me?
Let's see, what can we do to hear you a little better?
Hello.
Uh-oh, let's see. Maybe our technical people can help us. I wonder, can you move closer?
Hello, can you hear me?
Just barely.
Hello.
Can you move a little closer?
Well, I'm as close as I can.
Let's see if we can do some adjusting on this end that might help. You know, it's wonderful to have people to help you. There you go. I can hear you now.
Hello.
I can hear you now. We're cool. Now, today I'm looking forward to talking with us. We've got various issues to talk about. Now, I want to begin with a recent milestone that you had that has inspired you to consider an conversation as an elder, a new title that you earned, elder.
Yes.
And I understand that you see an urgent need to inspire other elders to speak up right now, that this is the time for elders not to shut up, but for elders to speak up. I want to hear a little bit more about why is that something that elders need to do right now, and what's your take on where a conversation with elders might go. Tell us about it.
Well, first of all, Norma, I'm afraid I've just turned 65. And 65 is the official age of seniorship in our nation.
Okay.
Getting my Medicare card, looking at issues of Social Security.
Okay.
Receiving my retirement pension, things like that, and things like that. So, my house is paid for, my cars are paid for. I don't buy clothes anymore like I used to.
Wait. Put a pin in that. That is gosh, I'm going to call it a blessing. I'm just going to call it a blessing. Just imagine the number of other elders who can't say that. So that, let's just put a pin in that and pause for a second and appreciate. Tell us that again. Go on,
well,
go on.
Again, I'm 65. My home is paid for. My cars are paid for. I don't buy as many clothes. I wear my black uniform all the time. I call it my uniform, if you will. And I enjoy my chickens, my garden. I still work. I'm not retired. I'm refired. I'm doing something else in
retired.
Life.
Wait a minute. Hold on. Not retired.
No, not retired.
Refired.
Mm. Yes. Mm. I'm not waiting for the people to bring me meals on wheels. I grow my meals. Collard greens, purple hull peas, hens, fresh eggs, exercising all the time. So I want to show what the new 65-year-old African-American man looks like and act like.
Okay.
As well as African-American people. To be an elder is an honorable place in any culture.
Oh, wow.
But for us African-Americans, we have not had an opportunity to make it an honorable space.
Mm.
Because of the suffering in America.
Okay.
And because of the issues and struggles.
Mm.
As you see behind me, that's an image of the Sankofa bird. So I call these my Sankofa years now.
Okay.
Which means it's time for me to reach back and fetch
as I go
forward. So we have to pass this on to the next generation.
Let me jump in. You said now that you've reached this juncture, it has come to your brain that it's time to reach back and fetch and then pass it on. Oh my goodness.
I'm gonna explain it to reach back. What is happening is that we as African Americans have not had historically the opportunity because of the struggles that we've lived under slavery and Jim Crow to really in a comfortable space reclaim our past and pass on. A culture, a group, that's how our children grow, by us passing on. I'm 65. I will submit to you that my generation of baby boomers, because we were all baby boomers from 46 until 64 roughly, but my generation was that generation who could move out. My mother and father couldn't do what I did. I came to Dallas along with others and received a job at SMU, others were at AT&T, Rockwell. I mean, all so many corporations that we did at that time. So we are the professional, if you will, generation. And because of that, now here we are, with generation.
Okay.
It is our responsibility now to reach back. And I call these the Sankofa years because I am committed now to the next 10 years. I have a plan.
Okay.
I know my years. I have a 10-year plan that we want to engage in the Sankofa years. I'll be calling friends and others of my generation. We will reclaim three things, reclaiming our history, reclaiming our culture, and reclaiming our values. Those are critical for us to pass on to the next generation so that they can move forward with a better understanding of our history as a people, our cultures, our culture, our music, our food, our art, our literature, how we can make money on our culture, et cetera, how we can embrace our culture with our art, how we invest in our art, and et cetera, our music, and then our values, family values. Values of what it means to be a man, values of what it means to be a young woman, a young man, so that the culture can become healthy. We're not healthy right now. And so I say to my contemporary, those of my contemporary 65, this is and those of us who are a little older than I am, even yourself and others, we now must speak up because I find so many elders today who are seemingly intimidated by younger people. They don't speak up. And so just as I've been an activist all of my adult life, I'm now an activist as I go into my senior citizen years.
You know, you've said a mouthful, and I have seen it. I'm not the only one who has seen it, that when elders reach a certain stage, they do begin to feel intimidated by younger generations, and they do begin to feel that their voice will no longer be heard. And it's almost like I've amassed all of this knowledge and wisdom. I'm going to use the word wisdom over these years. But now I'm told, sit down, shut up, get out of the way. You're old fogey. You have nothing to offer. But I hear you saying that it's time to take all of that amassed wisdom and do something with it.
Because historically, African-American people, African people in America were not respected by the general society. We were not seen as individuals that had a legitimate place in society. And so subsequently, our home life, and all things that really happened, let me back up a little bit. The church was the only place that we had it, really. And it was in the community as well, doing segregation. Let me go back and give a historical narrative. So when we had, during that time, there was a great deal of respect in the church when we were segregated because we were in our own communities. But when we came out of segregation into integration, I submit that the voice of the African-American elder began to be suppressed, if you will, because we left the church, we left our home values, we took on some of the dominant cultural values where elders are not oftentimes acknowledged as much. We took on some of the values where they call the elders by their first name. We took on a generation, there was a generation that said that I want it my way. You know, I don't have to listen to you. So all of these things impacted our culture over the last 30 years, I submit to you. So we have to go back. That's what Sankofa means to fix. What do we have in church? What do we have in, like we all know, you and I and others, because if my neighbor could correct me, my neighbor down the street could correct before I got home. And I couldn't tell my mama that Miss Newsom or Miss Willie or Mr. Ned said something. No, you must have done something wrong, you know, from Mr. Newsom, Mr. Ned, or Miss Willie, because the adults respected each other.
Right.
And we in the village raised the children. It simply takes us to raise a child in the village, and the village has elders. We really lost this in the last 30 or so years. And so that's what I mean by the Sankofa Project, you know, Sankofa years, that drawn me in. In the next 10 years, we're going to reach back and put in place. Even now, I'm thinking about having a ritual ceremony as my eldership.
Okay.
To let people come. And like, no, I'm an elder now. And that's a part of people need to see eldership as being an honorable place as we did in our motherland in Africa. So that the elders, these are the elders of our community now. This is how elder looks, talk, walk, act, speak, if you will. In the culture community, African culture, we call them Baba. Baba Glover, Nana. These are ways that we can say these are the values that we want to restore in our community.
Okay, I got a question. It sounds overwhelming. Now, I just have to confess, it sounds overwhelming. It can be done. I believe it can be done, and I think it sounds like the approach that you're taking, first to begin by organizing like-minded people who have the same experience, and I'm assuming will have the same mindset and maybe not have the passion that you have, but to develop that passion along the way. But I want you to tell me, how will the elders break through to the young minds who have already decided you have nothing to offer me? How would they go about breaking through that?
First of all, you recognize that they're children, they're young people. Young people are young people. We've all been young. We've all been adults. We've all been rebellious. That's nothing new. Nothing new to a young person saying, I don't want to listen to what mama say, daddy say. So that's nothing new. That's, they have no corner on that attitude. We have to recognize that we're going through that as well. What we must simply do is do what our ancestors did. I'm an adult. I am an adult. Not just that I'm an adult, I am now an elder who's a senior adult. That's who I am. And no one will compromise that, you see. And so we have to be able to be in that position and say, this is who we are. Just as you're young, and when you have a young adult who's maybe 15, 16, 17, for example, there's a child behind him or her.
Okay.
2 or 3.
Okay.
15, 16, 17. They were babysitters, but I was growing up. They take care of the 3-year-olds and the 5-year-olds back in the day.
Right.
And then you had the 25s and 20s who were ahead of the 16, 17-year-olds.
Yeah.
So we had this developmental stage of in our community. So each one of us, once we reach a certain age, particularly, say, let's say 10 years old, once we reach the age of 10, that's usually the age that we can say some sense of responsibility. Go get your little baby brother over there. Go get your little sister.
Yeah.
That's responsibility. Yeah. Hold her, feed her.
Right.
And from that age on, there's always somebody behind you. But there's always somebody in front of you as well. So by being seeing that system of relationship, we know that we have to give back to this generation to give back to the next generation. And the only way they're going to learn is to learn from the people who come before them, you see.
Now, I got to jump in. You, it is known that you have, for a number of years, held, what would I call them, training, for lack of a better word, training sessions with young African-American males, training them about manhood and about the values that you're talking about now. I think you still do some form of that. I'm not that sure. But why did you feel it was important to focus on young African-American males at that stage of life and to begin to teach them, what is that? And you'll tell me that phrase that you have about the brain. And I think you say it to them enough that they begin to believe it. Why was that important?
Because first, I'm a male. I'm a male child. And I was raised by men and women, but I was raised by men who brought me up to a certain age. Again, at 10, I knew I could look back and do things at a certain age. Start cutting the yard, taking the trash out of the house. I was held responsible for those things. I grew up on my great-grandfather's plantation, cotton farm, so I had chores to do. So this is my life. I understand the role of an elder, a worker to go out and get water from the water pump, or gather wood, et cetera, et cetera. My grandfather, who was a scoutmaster, we went camping, and I grew up in the 4-H. I killed chickens, and we also killed hogs in my community, learning how to get food, raise food, kill food. So as I can take those, that's who I am.
So
be able to take young boys, we started a program in South Dallas, and I had young men who were in that program. And I took it from the subject days ago, Boys in the Hood, which to me was a very destructive view of our culture by John Singleton.
Okay.
And I changed it to Men in the Hood. And that if we were to raise men, then the boys must see men in the hood, not boys in the hood.
Okay.
And I took these young boys, and they saw the men in the community owning stores, working, et cetera. I had speakers to come to them. The motto was, yesterday I was a boy, today I'm becoming a man. Tomorrow I'll be more of a man and never a boy again.
Oh my gosh.
And so each day we become a man more and more. So we need to know what it means to become a man, spiritually, emotionally, physically, intellectually. And many of these young men have gone on to do quite well. They see me in the community now. I do it on my street. It's not just formal, but it's informal. One of the young men I taught how to cut grass years ago came from a single family home. He has several brothers and sisters now. He's cutting grass. He has his own lawn company. He has his brother working with him. He has a truck. So I had a young man years ago I taught to paint in Louisiana in the CETA program. He had another young man. He went on to start his own painting company in Louisiana. So this is what we do. My father did it, so I do it. Now I'm a senior. My father passed when I was a very young man. And I was in seminary in 81. So I lost my father at a very young age for him as a male. But he had already instilled in me so much. And so as a result of that, I could not help but pass other things on as well.
Share with us that you're saying about the brain that you young African-American males about. You're saying about the brain, your brain.
Well, I've talked about a couple of things here. Take a chance off your brain so your mind can work. And what we do, that's the motto of my business, because that's what I do. We are physical shackles that have been on our bodies, but the real oppression is in the mind.
But would you say it again?
You take the chain. But my motto, my company, Professor Freedom, taking the chains off your brain so your mind can work.
Oh, I love it.
Because the brain is the physical object. The brain is a physical object. And as my students learn, they say, the brain is, you can see your brain is the size of your two fists put together. The brain is the mind does. The brain is the mind does. The mind is the creative energy that you hear me talking, that's my mind. You hear me, see me writing, that's my mind. You see, that's my mind expressing itself.
Okay.
Like my body, are the various components of my frontal lobe. It's the frontal lobe of the brain doesn't develop until, for girls, it's about 22. That's why girls develop quicker than boys. It's
okay.
Your rational thinking. For boys, the brain develops around 25.
Mm-hmm.
25 to 20. And so, therefore, when children are doing things as adults, that's why we must understand brain processes, is that they say, why'd you do that? You act like, I don't know. They don't
exactly,
know.
Exactly.
They truly don't know. They have no risk. They have not developed that rational thinking. So as adults, we have to recognize that these are the way. So once they get to a certain age, because when you get to a certain age, if you keep acting irrationally, that's why you're under the supervision of your parents until a certain age. So you want to help them grow and develop, because they can act irrationally at home and at school up to a certain age.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
But then the law says after 18, if you do that, you're going to jail.
Yes, that's exactly what it says. Right.
So yes, you're going to jail. And so, so we lose a lot of our young people because they're acting irrationally after they leave home, but now they have to go to jail.
Okay.
So
let me say this. We've got several things to talk about. If you have another point you want to make about the Elder Project, please make it. But then I want to move on. Then I want to move on to our other topic. It was there another point you wanted to make?
Well, I want to encourage people to elders, 65 and older. And if they're listening to me on your show, to submit it to your show. We want to begin names and so forth. We need to meet. I'm at 65. I don't plan to sit around and just vegetate.
Okay.
And so we need to have our functions and places where we gather in the firm, and not just in the nursing homes and the senior citizen homes, you see.
Okay.
But we need to be able to have our places to walk and talk and so forth. So we'll be saying more about that in the future.
Right. And I will go ahead and say now, while we're at this juncture, that we will place on the screen and in the chat how individuals can reach you through your email, through your phone, your cell phone, through your website, and we will display those that contact information. Yes, it's scrolling on the screen now. It is scrolling, and so. Other elders who are listening, please reach out to Professor Clarence E. Glover Jr., also known as Professor Freedom, and become a part of this Elder Project. I'm going to stay tuned to it. I might join myself.
Well, you're putting it out there, so you
might join myself. But let's do that now. I would like to move now. You are heading up a very interesting project with the new Piedmon Hotel in Deep Ellum. And you can tell us the story about it, but generally it's known in Dallas that it was the Knights of Pythian building, and that a number of local African-American leaders have tried different things over the years to save the building, but you'll tell us all about that. But currently, it's called not only the Piedmon Hotel, but it's called, sometimes you'll see it called the Crimpton Piedmon Hotel. Those are the people behind the reorganization of that building. But I am fairly pleased that we did not lose that historic building, the Knights of Pythias building, with this very strong ties to local African-American history.
tell us what's going on and where you see that project headed.
Well, yes, William Sidney Pittman, who was the grandson of Booker T. The son-in-law of Booker T. Washington. Mm-hmm. He married Portia Washington, and they moved to Dallas, Texas. He was one of the first African American architects in the country, one of the first here in Dallas for sure. And he has a number of architectural structures throughout the country.
Okay.
Here in Dallas, we have St. James AME, we have St. Paul AME, where he assisted in that, as well as Greater Bethel. And then, of course, the Knights of Pythian, which is an African-American fraternal organization down on Elm Street.
Okay.
That was the first building in Dallas built with African-American money for African-Americans.
Okay.
Not only did it house the Knights of Pythian, it had some of the first doctor's offices, stores. So that the Deep Ellum is the area of town that African people, along with others, in other freedmen areas like Joffe, like Stringtown, Frogtown, Short North Dallas, where they went for safety.
Okay.
Away from the city. We didn't have cars there, so this was a long way to be. So it's called Deep Ellum because the elm tree, but we African Americans call it Deep Ellum. And they lived down there. This was the cotton area.
Okay.
Within 150 miles of Dallas, we raised cotton.
Okay.
And this is what Dallas was built on. So Dallas is a cotton town, not a cattle town.
Okay.
It's a cotton town. So what happened, as African people moved into East Dallas, even close to Fair Park, we have Congo Street. It's the shortest street in Dallas, a one-lane street. It's been restored. And then they moved in, but then Robert Munger from Mejia,
okay.
He brought the cotton gin industry. He built the cotton gins that would make the bales of cotton. And then Henry Ford brought a plant down there to build some of the most earliest Model T Fords. And then the Jews came and they put up businesses because blacks and Jews were not allowed to come to downtown Dallas. So subsequently, that's where African Americans would come after they picked cotton, spend their money, music. Blind Man Lemon, Hedy Ledbetter, all sort of people, Robert Johnson, et cetera, et cetera. So
now, let me jump in. I believe it was it 1916 when it was built? It was 1950, so that was, again, we had talked about earlier, when the Klan and all of that was really strong.
Because this is, and that's why I said earlier, it was a place for safety.
Okay.
Freeman towns were places where people could feel safe away from Klan activity, other fine strength along the Trinity or the back Deep Ellum. You have to put it in a historical context.
Mm-hmm.
So we had this place. So and long story short, that once things changed, many African Americans began moving out of what we call the South, looking for new jobs. They left Deep Ellum.
Okay.
And for a while, it became a place of vagrants, and then some artists began moving in, and they started doing artists, or white artists came in.
Mm-hmm.
And more recently, in the 1990s and the 20s, they began to develop it into lofts. So the cotton gin industry became lofts, the Henry Ford, all these other things. And now there's a whole developmental economic system. The Pittman was bought and now managed by Kipton Hotel. So what I've done, I have been doing research on William Sidney Pittman for a number of years, going to his grave, taking flowers, et cetera. But now I want to make sure that when the Pittman opened, that we will be present. So the other weekend in April, his birthday is April 21st, William Sidney Pittman.
My
birthday is April 19th.
Okay.
So I said, let's have a birthday party. So you invited and you came and others came to the party. And the German man, we had a great time. And I had bricks from the building when it renovated. I gave him a brick, and I stayed there. I watched the guests come in. I saw them. And so now it's a place that we can come to, eat breakfast, eat dinner at the Pittman, encourage African-Americans to come and share. We were working on things like menus, so there'll be hopefully food like collard greens there and other things that we have on Sunday afternoon. We're also talking about wanting to try to develop a Deep Ellum African-American Culture Center down there. I'm talking to some individuals right now, businessmen and women. I want us to get serious about that so that out of what the meeting at the birthday, and I coined the term the Deep Ellum African American Cultural Society, because we have to be present. That's our history. It's like Native Americans who said that land is sacred. That land, that those streets are sacred. Many of you are from Dallas, your grandparents and great-grandparents, and walked those streets. And you all should be mindful of that. Just like when I go to Louisiana, I know we went under the bridge on Texas Avenue. That's where we had to go.
Okay.
You all need to acknowledge when your elders, somebody, they know about Deep Ellum. They know about walking up and down Deep Ellum and so forth.
Okay.
And we got to start talking about it.
Let me jump in. Now, we're very familiar. I'm assuming all of us descendants of Africa are very familiar with gentrification. That is where people of other cultures, not ours, come to areas that once belonged to us, that were valuable to our people, our culture, our existence, our livelihood. We either were run out, ran away, or left them, and then people of other cultures came in and made big money industries out of areas like you're talking about. So what I hear you saying, and tell me if I'm wrong, is that it's incumbent upon us not to allow gentrification to happen in Deep Ellum, where what was once ours is turned over to other cultures, and we have no input, no investment in it. So I hear you urging us to step forward. Am I right? Am I wrong?
Well, first of all, gentrification has already happened in Deep Ellum.
Okay.
So the gentrification has already happened. It happens all over Dallas.
Mm-hmm.
The issue becomes whether or not, as African Americans, we're able to value pieces of land that our ancestors lived on. As I shared with you earlier, is that we, America suffers from a what I call historical disregard, which is the act of not recognizing a part of history of our as African Americans. Historical disregard. We're just going to disregard that history, not even going to acknowledge it. And then as African Americans, we suffer from cultural deficiency syndrome.
Okay.
Meaning that we don't acknowledge our own culture, our own music, our own food, our own art, because we've been programmed to see the negative. So by the time we leave, we don't want to have anything to do with that. We leave it. And so somebody does come in and gentrify it and take it. Or either, like in my case, where I live, North Dallas, I've been here for some 30 years, and people who, when I got here, was all African American, but many African Americans began to pass away. During my early years in my community, I tried to get professional African Americans to move over here.
Okay.
They didn't see the value.
Okay.
We have a little bungalow house.
Uh-huh.
I want a two-story house in the pool in DeSoto.
Now we're
talking
like the Lover's Lane area.
Elm Thicket North Park.
Okay.
Yeah, and so now you can't buy in here unless you have a million or so, you see. The property taxes are going up, yes, but I'm 65 now, so I'm getting my homestead. I'm getting my 65-year.
Yes.
Our grandparents say, buy some land. That's the only thing that God has to make it more. And that's the only thing that goes up and doesn't come down.
Say that again.
Buy some land because that's the only thing that God is not making any more of. And it goes up and not down. And so we must become more mindful as elders and passing on to our generation. So what we're doing in Deep Ellum is culturally embracing Deep Ellum.
And
that's what I'm calling. And so there may be some African Americans in the future who may want to start businesses down there.
Okay.
We want to look at our festivals. The fourth Monday in October, I've designated it as National African American Cotton Pickers Day.
Okay.
So I'm looking forward to having the events in Deep Ellum, because that's where the cotton industry in Texas got its biggest boom, because the cotton gin making industry was there, and Dallas became the largest inland cotton exchange in the nation. Dallas was built on cotton. And if Dallas was built on the cotton industry, and during that time, we were the fundamental cotton pickers. We picked the cotton that built the industry.
Okay.
So
okay.
Therefore, we must have a commitment to and an investment in cotton and the culture, the music, the art, and all the things that come out of it, you see.
Okay, let me just take a quick little break, and then I want to focus on a question that we really must deal with. I'm just reminding our audience that you are watching and listening to the Blog Talk Show. I was just thinking, I am your host, Norma Adams Wade. You are my co-host, and we are visiting with Professor Clarence E. Glover, Jr. He's an educator. He's an entrepreneur. He's a consultant. He's very passionate about instilling in the next generation values that elders can pass on. And he's got a number of projects going, and he wants to start a new one where we bring together elders who can contribute to the next generation, contribute philosophically and culturally and what have you to the next generation. So having said, it is now, it's now 12:30, and this show is brought to you by publisher Cheryl Smith Media Enterprise that includes Texas Metro News, the Garland Journal, and the iMessenger Media online publication. Now, speaking of the cotton, let me, I guess I'm going to say, bring up the elephant in the room. And to me, the elephant in the room is this mindset that we have been taught and generations following us, African-American descendants following us, we've been taught, I don't want anything to do with cotton. I want to get as far away from the cotton field as I can. It hurts your back, blah, blah, this, blah, blah, that. How do you get past that mindset? How do you begin to re-educate, to reprogram our view of our relationship with cotton?
During the anti-apartheid movement here in America, which I was a participant of in the 80s, we worked with many South Africans, Bishop Tutu, Alan Bosack, and others here in America to work toward the disenfranchise of the get companies out of South Africa, if you will.
Okay.
But when you think about one of the principal things in South Africa that was going on, that the men who were in the mines were digging diamonds. They were digging diamonds in South Africa. I submit to you that after apartheid, I don't think you find too many African men or women who would say to you that all that hard digging and working that we did in those mines over the years of apartheid, and so now that we're free, we're going to run away from the diamonds and the mines that we dug.
Stop it, I
say. We don't want those. I don't want to do nothing with that mine.
I don't want those diamonds.
I don't want to be around those diamonds. We don't recognize that this was called white gold in America.
Whoa.
This is king cotton.
Whoa.
White gold. This is white gold. So you're telling me you're going to run away from the white gold?
Oh, my gosh.
That's one of the most psychological, that's one of the most devastating change. To get us to see this soft, beautiful cotton as being an evil object, or even to see the work that we did in the field as bad. See, there's nothing wrong with picking cotton.
Okay.
There's something wrong with not getting paid for picking cotton.
Say it again.
There's nothing wrong with picking cotton. There's something wrong with not getting paid for picking cotton. After slavery, other African-American men, my great-grandfather was one, had a plantation, had cotton pickers. We had our own cotton pickers.
Wow.
I, as a child, saw men and women pick my great-grandfather's cotton. But he paid them. He treated them with respect, you see. So subsequently, we must understand that cotton is the foundation of the Industrial Revolution.
Okay.
You almost must understand that for every dollar bill that's in your pocket,
uh-huh.
$10 bill, $100 bill, that's not paper. Every dollar bill in the pocket is made from 75% cotton and 25% linen.
Oh, my goodness.
It's not paper at all. So what's in your pocket is cotton. One bale of cotton that is big will make 300 bills.
Say it again. Every bale of cotton will make
300 bills.
Oh my goodness.
And in Africa they would take cotton and spin it into thread and turn it into fabric. And this is what Dallas was built on, the fabric industry over on 35, the Paramount. Because Dallas was known as the fashion town. So you go from fiber, which is cotton fiber, to fabric, which you make from the thread, fashion, which becomes the clothes. And I'm spinning cotton here as we do in Ghana, West Africa. So we must go back as elders now and teach our young people and children that there's value in this cotton, because this cotton now makes the clothes we wear, and the world is covered in cotton. And so we're going to the industry.
Whoa. So back to Deep Ellum and the Piedmont, and you have lined up with leaders in that area to try to make the owners, current owners of that land, more to respond more to the local audience of descendants of Africa and bring them more into that area and into that hotel that bears the name of the first African American architect in certainly in Dallas and the Southwest. You are wanting us, descendants of Africa locally, to appreciate and come in and become part of that Deep Ellum Piedmont Hotel culture. Is that correct? I think I lost you. Let's see. Maybe we'll get him back in a minute. I think we're froze. We'll pause a little bit. While we can try to unfreeze, we are talking with Professor Clarence C. Glover Jr. We'll get him back in a minute, but he's blowing our mind. He's blowing our mind about the history of cotton, our investment in cotton, and what he told us in a riveting way is that we have no need to be ashamed of ourselves as having picked cotton because there was such a value. He called it white gold. He said cotton is well known as white gold, almost like the diamonds in the motherland of Africa. And so he said the shame was not in the picking of the cotton, but it was that we didn't get paid. We didn't get paid for that valuable product that our whole history surrounds. And so what he's saying now is that he's got all kind of various projects going. First of all, to bring attention to our contribution, our valued contribution, not to our shame with cotton, but to our honor with having been a part of that valuable industry. And he's telling us how that area around Deep Ellum, which is right there, y'all, it's right there at Good Latimer and Main. That's where that Piedmont Hotel is very near. It's very near the area of Good Latimer and Main. The address is 2551 Elm Street. That's the address of the Piedmont Hotel, 2551 Elm Street, and it's right near Good Latimer. You come out of South Dallas, go up Good Latimer till you get to Main. I'm sorry, till you get to Elm, And there you have it. And what you will see, you can go online and see some photographs of how the redevelopment people took that original Pythian temple. It was a gorgeous, solid structure built in that opened in 1916. Well over 100 years ago. And they took the original structure and they enhanced it and redesigned it, but kept the essence of that building. If you go and visit, there is, I'm thinking Professor Glover will come back soon. But a lot of the history is throughout that building now. It could be even more, but a lot of the history is there. And it talks about how the redevelopers took the old and the new ideas, and it's now called a boutique hotel. And that sounds real fancy, but that's what it's known as now. It's known as a boutique hotel. And they took many of the, the designs of the past and retained them and brought it into modern time. And then they talk about how Deep Ellum was such a rich, vibrant area of early musical artists, Blind Lemon Jefferson and people of that ilk, and how people, entertainers, African-American entertainers would come to visit Dallas and they would entertain in the Pythian Temple, and there's that ballroom. I'll go ahead and jump the gun and tell you about that ballroom, but I visited when Professor Glover had an event to help promote the Pittman, and that ballroom is absolutely gorgeous. But the African American high schools would have their proms in that ballroom, and you go up there now. It's beautiful, beautiful facility. It's got a lot of the old turn of the century qualities to it that have been enhanced. Beautiful lighting systems and what have you. But then sororities and fraternities and social organization and business, African-American business organizations would have soirees and banquets and entertainment events in that ballroom. It was a come-together place for Dallas African-Americans. So we're really learning a lot about it. And if you're having, I think we're about to get him back. If your organization is having, there you are. Okay, tell us about that ballroom. I was trying to give my view. Tell us about the ballroom at the Pittman Hotel.
The ballroom was the social life in Dallas for many years. On the fourth floor, it's a beautiful restored ballroom. The outside of the building could not be touched, but the ballroom has been restored, and it was where many other social events were held, and weddings have been held there now, and other events have been held there. So I just hope that the community will look to have events there in the future, churches, sororities, et cetera, in that ballroom, and family reunions, et cetera.
Okay. Now, I want to move quickly to the current exhibit. You've got an exhibit at the African-American Museum, and it ties in with Color of Money, I think it's called. The one of the main exhibits called The Color of Money that's been touring, I believe, across the country, and you have a portion of it. Tell us about your exhibit on cotton that ties in with the Color of Money exhibit. Tell us.
Well, Mr. Johnson, who developed the Color of Money exhibit out of South Carolina, it was an exhibit where he found that Confederate money during the 1860s, particularly 1861, during the time of the Confederate, the Civil War, that they took African-American people picking cotton and working on plantations and used as images on Confederate currency.
Okay, now let me pause you right there. That is such a riveting piece of information, because I don't think it's well known that during that Confederate time, African Americans picking cotton were shown on money. Go ahead.
That's right. That African Americans were used on currency during that time, and you could not see them very well. And so what happened was that he took these images and he blew them up into acrylic, beautiful colors, of course, showing and depicting African Americans in these cotton fields and the plantations as the gin factories and so forth. And it's at the African American Museum now, going throughout July. And I was asked to bring in an installation that complements the exhibit. And my installation is called Cultures, Cotton, and Commerce, which reflects the two major cultures in the cotton field, African and European, one in the field picking the cotton, the other looking over them as they pick the cotton.
Okay.
And so my installation, I have two cotton bags from slavery and Jim Crow era are there, which represents the man and woman picking cotton and the overseer watching them. And the cotton would attach money to it, representing the fact that dollars are money, not paper, from cotton. And then we have a 500-pound cotton bale there. And this 500-pound cotton bale, which was gin here in Texas, I have two of them, one of the very few African Americans, probably maybe the only one that has two 500-pound cotton bales, because I pick cotton. And so this installation reflects what you see in the pictures on the wall. And so you go there with a little cute, they hit it, they'll tell you about what he's doing. And then I have information there that you can pull. And I have an image also of women separating the cotton, as I showed earlier, with mm-hmm. full of the cotton gin. Mm-hmm. And so it's a very intense exhibit. So I encourage people to go by and look at it, particularly on the weekends, Friday to Saturdays is a good time to go, especially.
Okay, and my understanding is if you want to specifically get the hours and the days when the African American Museum is open, visit aadallas.org. Is that it? aadallas.org, I believe. Anyway, at any rate, check out the website of the African American Museum and visit their website and get the hours and the days of
Tuesday, Thursday, Friday, and Saturday now, I believe, from
ten to five. Okay, very good, very good. So please go. It will be an experience to see. I mean, you know, we learn something every day.
There are other exhibits, of course, for women, called the Peers Exhibit, Reconciling Exhibit. Then there's another one downstairs. So there's two other exhibits, I think, along with the Freedman Cemetery exhibit also.
Okay. We've got about 10 minutes, less than 10 minutes left. I do want to, you were going to visit with us earlier in May, but we had some technical problems. You were going to tell us about an African-American link to the Cinco de Mayo celebration in our last 8 or so minutes. Tell us about what link does African-American history have to Cinco de Mayo, which is a holiday for Mexican citizens and descendants.
You will hear more about it in the future, but Cinco de Mayo, 5th of May, represents the Battle of Puebla. Napoleon III, who was with the French, was trying to get cotton into France. And so subsequently, he was trying to support the South during the Civil War. Also, what we know, or I have known for years and now we'll be sharing, is that in the 1500s, a gentleman by the name of Yanka, his name is Yanka, for he was a royal prince who was captured. They took him to the plantations in Spain there at the time, in what's called Mexico now. And he worked for he's a maroon, a man who fought. They went to the mountains. He went to the highest peak there in Mexico, in the Olmec Mountains. He built farms there, and they stayed there. And he also began to fight the Spaniards.
Okay.
He would take food, and they were, you know, so long story short there, he actually had an agreement with Spain, and they gave him land there in Veracruz. Those people mixed in like they did in the Moors did in North Africa, went into Spain. That was the first mixture of blacks into Spain, turning them brown and dark hair. Then Yanka here, and so there is now a town in Mexico called Yanka Veracruz, Yanka.
Okay.
And he's called El Yanka, El Yanka.
Okay.
And for years I looked at that, I would hear that the story about a Pueblo was fought by the soldiers there and against France, the Spaniards against France, and then you had these pitchfork Mexicans, just farmers. Well, what we came to find out is that over a period of years of research, and even at the reenactment in Mexico, the farmers have their straw hats on.
Okay.
Their faces are black. They're painted black. And they are representing the black, I submitted my research, they are representing the black maroons of Yanka's descendants.
Wow.
And they were not simply just anybody. They were actual warriors, men who, they were not farming, they were fighting. So
Whoa. They
were farmers and fighters. So they were farmers. So as a result of that, that Battle of Pueblo influenced the Civil War because it gave Abraham Lincoln enough time to build up the reinforcements in America. If it had not been so, then the South may have taken a different turn here. So the Battle of Pueblo is clearly connected to the Civil War here in America, and not only the Civil War, but also the history of the men who fought in the Battle of Pueblo. So sometimes they call them Afro-Mexicans, but I submit to you that all Mexicans are mixed with Africans because the first is the Spanish, the second is the Moors, and the third is the Native American Indian. And Moors are oftentimes left out. That's why they have the name Montemoros, which means kill Moors and kill the blacks. So what we must understand is that Africa is a part of the mestizo of the Mexican identity.
Wow.
But it has been reduced because of the caste system like they do in India and
uh-huh.
in America.
Uh-huh.
So now, today, I am sharing this information so that Second Back in South Dallas right now at the Forest Theater.
Okay.
You can go over there today. There's a huge mural. I encourage you to go see it on black Hispanic. Someone put it up there. I don't know who painted it, but it is there in South Dallas. And most people are just walking by with no sense of the fact that we now must learn our Spanish language. And here in Dallas, all African Americans, this is another movement, all young African Americans should be learning Spanish. Because in the next 10 to 20 years, if you cannot speak Spanish in Texas, they will be linguistically disenfranchised from employment. You cannot say Spanish. You can say bilingual preferred. Preferred language is Spanish, but you cannot say Spanish preferred. So African children must do that. Just like Hispanic is not just one group. There are Puerto Rico, Dominican Republic, all that. So we must embrace dual language and be able, as we do in Africa, speak two or three languages. So teach your children to learn Spanish and learn the African roots of Hispanic culture and history.
Professor Clarence E. Glover, Jr., it has been an honor, a pleasure, and an education to have you visit with us. Thank you so much for coming, and keep us abreast of these various projects that you're talking about. Do you have any points that we didn't get to in our next two minutes?
Well, we will be bringing forth more things in the future. Certainly look out for the National African American Cotton Pickers Day. If you have a cotton picker in your family, try to give them honor and respect. Talk about cotton. Discuss cotton as an industry, as an option for a career. We want people, African Americans, to really, really, really think about cotton as our white gold. and we're going to go out and get our white gold. Now it's time to get our white gold. And then, I think before you left, I think I heard you say the word, we were going to try. I don't know what the word try means. My father didn't bring a try as he brought up. He raised doers.
Okay.
And so we were going to do. My mother also raised doers. Our goal is to go and develop in the Elam, an African-American cultural society, so that they know that we are there and we will be respected for our history and our culture, and particularly Deep Ellum, unlike other areas like Uptown, where you are totally, like, as you all know, you are totally left out here in Dallas, in this community.
Right.
But down in Deep Ellum, you have pictures up on the street live that they talk about the blues and the jazz and the blind limbs. That's us. But you can't talk about us and not us being present.
Mm. Say that again. You can't what now?
You can't talk about us and us not be present.
I'll take that. Professor Clancy Glover Jr., thank you so much. We'll say goodbye and we will keep in touch with you. Bye
thank
now.
You so much, bye
All
now.
Right. Bye-bye. Okay. That was the nonstop. Professor Clancy Glover Jr., also known as Professor Freedom. And when he is in character as Professor Freedom, he has his long cotton sack, I don't know how many feet that is, but I get that whenever I see him in that character, I get that image of us walking through those fields and that long bag over our shoulder actually being filled with the cotton that our ancestors picked from the land. So thank you for visiting with us today, audience, my co-host. We will continue to reach out to the African-Americans in our community who are doing worthwhile, worthy, interesting, educational activities that will help move our culture forward. We got to wake up, everybody.
Wake up, everybody, no more sleeping in bed. No more back to thinking, time for thinking ahead. The world's changed so very much from what it used to be. There's so much hatred, war and poverty. Oh, wake up all the teachers, time to teach a new way. Maybe then they'll listen to what you have to say. They're the ones who's coming up and the world is in their hands. When you teach the children, teach them the very best you can. Better if we just let it be. Up